was his attempt more or less to take his sort of aggressive cost-cutting philosophy and bring it to the world of business computing, which didn't really go down too well. So again, rather than having a proper disk drive, it was using these sort of micro drives, which are these little postage stamp sized things with a tape loop in them. They're horribly unreliable. So yeah, this went down like a lead balloon in the business world. Although one of them did find its way into the hands of a certain Finnish student who had bought a Spectrum with his pocket money, a QL with pocket money, and used it to tinker around with operating systems. So we all know how that turned out. So, in the end, Sinclair had to sell off the Spectrum intellectual property to this guy, Alan Sugar, and the computing world moved on. The people moved on to the Atari ST and the Amiga and that sort of thing, and all across the country, the Spectrums generally got handed down to everyone's younger sibling, and which meant that there were companies like Codemasters that briefly made a killing out of these sort of cheap and cheerful, cartoony adventure games that was attractive to this new younger market and sold for like just a couple of pounds. So it was just total pocket money stuff. And in the Spectrum community today, I think Dizzy is kind of a bit of a Marmite thing. It's, a few nods there. In a way, it was the beginning of the end for the Spectrum. It's like a bit of derivative, and they carried on for a few years for this sort of thing, but eventually the supply of software from the likes of Codemasters also dried up, and the magazines sort of ran out of things to report on, so they ended up closing down. This is the big final issue, which is big in the sense that it was 64 pages rather than the 32 that it had gone down to. I think there was a general feeling that it's possibly the magazine cover tapes were part of the death of the Spectrum software industry, because people were saying that these magazines were just a pamphlet with a cover tape on the front. So this sort of, for the people who'd sort of stuck with the Spectrum right to the end, we sort of suddenly dropped sort of into the lurch a bit, and then there was still a community around, and it was being kept alive with these sort of fanzines, this sort of mail order, and it's a pretty nice sort of community in its own way. But it meant we'd kind of turned from it being the mass market thing to us being this sort of eccentric preservationist, sort of like steam engine enthusiasts or something. Incidentally, do you reckon that steam engine enthusiasts get really pissed off with the steampunk people? They're saying, yeah, you're just trying to ride on the coattails of the whole steam engine thing, but you're not actually really living the real thing, not really getting into the whole valves and things. So it's they must get really pissed off with that stuff. For a long time, the Spectrum being propped up by these sorts of fanzines, and I'll sort of derail a bit into a bit site which I didn't get any slides for, which is another sort of pretty active subculture within a subculture of the Spectrum, which is the demo scene, which I've sort of mentioned at some length in previous talks, but just as a bit of a recap, this is, it came out of the software piracy scene, where people would pirate these games, break the protection on them, and then to show that they'd done this, they'd put in a little intro sequence with their logo and a few flashy colours and things, as a sort of bit of digital graffiti, as it were. And eventually, this sort of took on its own life as an art form in its own right, and people dropped the whole game cracking side of things and just focused on the demos. And this went on the Spectrum as well. It was perhaps never quite as big as things like the Commodore 64 and the Amiga. But it was a fun thing to be a part of. It was people were it was the whole the mail swapping thing and rushing home from school eagerly, sort of hoping that there might be some jiffy bag from a far off land like Poland or Czechoslovakia as it was then, or who knows where. So people were using these demos as ways of exploring the hardware and just learning new tricks. And it was kind of, and I think that this summarized the Spectrum scene as a whole in this sort of era. It wasn't really driven by commercial pressures. People were able to really explore the Spectrum as a platform in its own right, and really discover what the hardware was really capable of. And one thing really sort of fed into this was the rise of emulators. So we didn't really have both feet in the past. We did, as well as sticking to the Spectrum, we had real computers as well. So emulators sprang up to let you to make your PC behave like a Spectrum, but with all of the annoying things like the 5-minute tape loading times cut out. So these collections sprang up, so you could like CDs you could get in HMV with sort of emulators and thousands of games that you could just instantly fire up, as time went on, people discovered a lot more. These emulators became more and more accurate. And as well, once the hardware was capable of emulating it at a lower and lower level, so as we discovered more about the Spectrum, these emulators improved as well. Now, around the middle to the end of the 90s, a lucky few of us got access to the internet, and what we found was something quite surprising. Was that what we thought was this sort of little island, this sort of tiny close-knit community, was just like one island out of many. And so once people got onto the internet, started Googling, or not Googling, AltaVistaing or whatever, for the Spectrum, we were discovering these other things happening around the world that we'd kind of missed out on the first time round. And so... So one example of this was during the Sarajevo War. There were a couple of guys who, in order to distract them from the horrors of this, they worked on a Spectrum emulator of their own. And there's an incredible story behind this of how they would have like maybe 1 or 2 hours of electricity a day, and they probably have power cuts like we had just before, but so during that they'd be coding frantically, and then during the rest of the time they'd be just working out algorithms on paper, and in the end they came up with something that was a pretty competitive emulator for against the other things that existed at the time, and it's really sort of amazing what they came up with there. Where it tied in with the European history is in the city of Toruń in Poland. It turned out there was a TV signal intrusion staged by the Solidarnosc, anti-Soviet movement, and this was done by a couple of academics at Toruń University using a Spectrum and this series of random bits of electronics. So the Spectrum's obviously been an inspiration to hackers throughout the ages, and it's also interesting to see how it's sort of feeding into these moments of European history. It's like the Spectrum is this sort of computer equivalent of Forrest Gump. It's this underdog where it's sort of surfacing every now and then and in these unexpected ways. But perhaps the most intriguing of all was what was going on in Russia, because it turned out that um, so So the Spectrum, it turns out at some point someone had managed to smuggle an original Spectrum through the Iron Curtain, and because of the way that Sinclair had driven down the costs and eliminated all this custom circuitry, like Ben Heck was saying about there was only really one custom chip, and if you were determined enough, you could replicate that in standard logic. And that's exactly what the boffins in Russia did. They came up with these designs that were basically, they got sort of passed around just these blueprints for these Spectrums reinvented with the locally available components, and pretty much every city and town in the Soviet Union that would have some kind of electronics geek who would have this little cottage industry of making these Spectrums out of whatever bits and pieces they had to hand, keyboards and things, whatever, bits of plastic. So it's all sorts of, whatever materials they had to hand. So if they had like a job lot of these 5-pin DIN sockets, then that's what they would use for all the connectors, regardless of whether it actually made any sense for that particular application. Because, yeah, it just make do with whatever materials they had available. This is the Sinclair philosophy reborn, effectively. And the sort of intriguing thing with this was that along with all the hardware, of course, came the software, pirated, of course, and they in fact had disk systems because they kind of adopted one British disk system. Sinclair never brought out an official disk system. He was still insistent on the microdrive stuff. But there's a couple of third-party ones, and one of them, a fairly obscure one called Betadisk, it found its way to Russia, and that became their standard. So they would receive these discs of pirated games from their sort of a local dealer. And because this was all happening in the sort of beginning of the 90s, they didn't really experience the whole progression of video games as we knew it. So things like sort of Jet Set Willy, that meant absolutely nothing to them, because they would sort of get these discs with like hundreds of games on, and well, for a Russian kid growing up with these things all at once, well, which one of them are you going to sort of leap on and say, yes, this is state of the art? And obviously it's going to be the Dizzy games. So these games that we in the West were kind of thinking this was like the low point of the Spectrum's software output. In Russia, this was this was like the absolute peak of achievements. Though Spectrum nostalgia in Russia is now all about Dizzy. So yeah, Jet Set Willy, Manic Miner means nothing. So now, yeah, we've come sort of full circle in a way with the Spectrum's sort of fashionable and retro again. These bags and things, and this ZX500 trainer, that is an actual Adidas product a few years back. I don't think they acknowledged that it was an officially licensed, but you can see what they were doing there. So so things are still going on with the Spectrum community. People are still discovering stuff. There's collaboration over the internet. So this is one thing that I sort of had to put in in Ben Heck's talk. There's a talk of recreating the ULA, the custom video chip, in discrete hardware. So this is the prototype of the Harlequin, which is Spectrum clone, which was built by a guy called Chris Smith, who's based in Wales, and he actually brought this along to a gathering of Spectrum geeks at a pub in Oxford. So these things go on every now and then. And I have to say, when the barmaids have came along to our table and saw this sort of mass of components and wires, she was a bit apprehensive and was like, "Is that a bomb?" So, and yeah, so I think it lost a bit of the few of the connections, got loose in transit. So I think once we finally got it working, we dared one of our party to shout out, "The bomb's working!" So yes, fun times. And another sort of major achievement of these Oxford pub meetups was we also had first glimpse of the Spectranet, which is the an Ethernet interface for the Spectrum. And it's a thing with a lot of these interfaces, you end up with the interface themselves are actually kind of doing, they have as much processing power on board as the original Spectrum, if not more. But it's still a nice intellectual pursuit. One thing that we got the first prototypes of this, so we were playing around with them at one of these meetings in Oxford, and we decided on the spot that what we'd try and do is get the Spectrum posting to Twitter. So this was again the much missed Gloucester Arms in Oxford, and this was the tweet from a Spectrum that we sent from the Spectrum to a laptop that was bridged to the local Wi-Fi hotspot. So I do think there really should be like a blue plaque on this pub now. The Spectrum tweet was sent from here. Unfortunately, you can't do this anymore because they've now enforced like OAuth and all sorts of things. But for a while, the guy who produced the Spectranet interface, he would like go to these retro computing fairs and he would have a Spectrum set up with a Twitter client where you could put in your username and password and people would go, "Look, Mum, I'm posting from a Spectrum on Twitter." That's pretty much all everyone typed, but... But yeah, you can't do that now because you've got to authenticate via OAuth. But because, well, to be fair, I think it was the entire point of Twitter moving to OAuth was to stop people setting up random bits of hardware saying, "Go on, enter your username and password into this box. It'll do something cool." So you can't really blame them on that. This Speccy 2010, which is the sacrilegious Spectrum in an FPGA that is developed by a Ukrainian developer, and this is actually my pride and joy. I'm using this for my concert later on. It's a nice compact thing. And these sorts of developments are happening all the time. It's really sort of fascinating international community. Incidentally, with the issue with some of these clones, if you're trying to make them above board, there's an issue with the Spectrum firmware, because since it was passed on from Sinclair to Amstrad, the intellectual property now ultimately resides with Rupert Murdoch. So if you actually want to build these things and ship them with the Spectrum ROM, then you would have to come up with some deal with him. So as a way of getting around this, I actually worked on a project a few years back to produce an open source clone of the Spectrum firmware that would actually reproduce let it run basic programs, and so it would be enough to run games and things. And one sort of coup for this project was that we sort of got hold of the ZX81 firmware, which due to various of legal oddities didn't go to Sky, so we were able to use some of the routines from there, which had then been passed on to the Spectrum, and those included the trigonometric math routines. So not only did I eventually find out what sine, cos, and tan did, I eventually became the custodian of the sine, cos, and tan routines. So and now it's made me realize that this must be what Stephen Moffat feels when growing up watching Doctor Who and then eventually becoming a writer on Doctor Who himself and running the show. And it's simple pleasures. It made me happy. And of course now we've got the likes of the Raspberry Pi to keep to really bring back this idea of a computer that encourages programming from the get-go rather than a computer that's just an appliance. And yeah, it's obviously, as we all know, it's a roaring success. It's hopefully going to inspire a new generation of programmers, just as I was with the Spectrum. And it might not have the keywords printed on the keys, but if it can help a few of the children of today slay their own bug-eyed monsters, then I think that the future's bright. So, thanks very much. So I think of the time for questions before I rush off. I think this is time for questions.
Why don't you just to explain this? I've noticed sometimes it's discussed with Spectrum, and also related with the sand coop. Is there any specific reason why?
The sand coop, that was touted as a successor to the Spectrum. This was, I guess, in a way, it was like more of the, it was like an 8-bit competitor to the ST and the Amiga, and I guess the selling point of it was that it was more or less compatible with at least some software for the Spectrum. So the makers of it were hoping that that would be a natural upgrade path. But I think it was that project, though, it was slightly sort of plagued by problems. I think they were too late in actually getting it to market by whichever particular Christmas it was, Christmas 1989, I think. So they'd kind of missed the boat, and people had already moved on to the ST and the Amiga, which meant that it never really became this sort of breakout of success in its own right. It always became a sort of postscript to the Spectrum, but throughout the 90s, it was it was a like, close-knit community. A lot of the fanzines were sort of Spectrum and Sam Coupe based, so there's a lot of shared heritage there. Thanks again. Right, and I'll rush off and hopefully see you at stage A.